is going to be a barrel of laughs this morning, can't you, from that passage? Okay. Yesterday morning, I was standing at the side of a soccer field while my son Alistair played in for the under 13 Eagles in the first of two finals. They won the home and away season, they were undefeated. The worst result they got was a draw. And now they're trying to push on to get the Premiership Cup. It was a tight match. It was a one-all draw at full time, and then they went into a penalty shootout. It was nerve-wracking if you're a parent, more nerve-wracking if you're a kid trying to shoot it, and more nerve-wracking if you're the goalie. It was a very good game and very significant and did lots to build, I think, maturity in the boys and nerves in the parents. But are we going to remember it next year? In 5 years? In 10 years, in 100 years, will it be a footnote in anybody's memory of anything? Steve Smith and others were involved in ball tampering. Now that got international coverage in the media. Will it be remembered in 100 years? Will it be a footnote in a cricket almanac somewhere in 100 years' time? Won't be in 500 years' time. I can assure you of that. You might remember Ross started our series with a great illustration of trying to catch wind. Because the preacher, the author of Ecclesiastes, says life under the sun, that means the life we live between birth and death on this planet, is hebel, which the NIV translates as meaningless and other translations translate as vanity. But hebel can also mean breath, as Mike told us. And it doesn't mean a thing is actually devoid of all meaning. It just means it's fleeting. It passes quickly. It has no lasting, enduring significance or meaning. It will pass away. It will be forgotten. It's significant at the time. But all the people who did it or worked for it or saw it happen, they will all die and be forgotten. It's impossible to hold on to control or to make a permanent gain or profit from anything that happens in our lives under the sun. That's what the preacher's saying. Now, he's conducting an experiment. He believes in God. He doesn't know about life after death. He believes there's a God, and he sets out to say, what's the meaning of life? And he's not working from revelation. He's working from observation and experiment. He says, I'm going to try and find out the meaning of life. I'm going to look at what's happening in the world under the sun, and I'm going to try a few different things. So if you go back and have a look at chapters 1 and 2, and although this is a difficult book, I think it's well worth having a careful read because it asks us some very piercing questions. So in chapters 1 and 2, he says he has tried many things, and he puts all of them into the hebel bucket. He tries wisdom, and he says it's vanity. There's no lasting gain. It's better to be wise than foolish, but it's not an enduring benefit that we take through all of our life or into the next life, if there is a next life. He tries every pleasure he can think of, and he says there's no lasting gain or meaning in that. He tries hard work and achievement, and he says there's no lasting gain. He tries great riches and possessions, political power, no lasting gain. I can't hold on to any of this. Time and chance happen to all of us, and they can blow these things away, and the people involved will be forgotten. And towards the end of chapter 2, he comes to this conclusion. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink, I'm with him there, and find satisfaction in their work. That's it. This too, I see, is from the hand of God, for without God, who can eat or find enjoyment? So that's what we've been through chapters 1, 2, part of chapter 3. How do we respond to this? My first thought is this guy is a misery guts who needs to be on antidepressants. But no, I think Ecclesiastes is in the Bible for a reason. It's there to make us face the reality of life under the sun. It's there to prick our bubbles of illusion and to give us wisdom for life. It's not the full revelation. He doesn't know about Jesus Christ. He doesn't know about life after death. He doesn't know about God wanting to adopt people into his family. He doesn't know all of that stuff. But what he does know, what he does observe, is valuable lesson for us. Because when we consider the shortness and the precariousness of our lives set against the thousands of years of human history, or the billions of years of galactic history, we know that if all there is to our life and death in this world, if all there is life and death in this world, then the preacher is right. There is no enduring significance or gain in anything we do or build under the sun. It will all be forgotten. There is temporary significance. There's manufactured meaning, but nothing lasting, nothing enduring. But most of the time we don't think that way. We actually live by shrinking our time horizons to the soccer match, or the preparation for the wedding, or this year. And we shrink our range of people and matters we're concerned about, and we think, well, this is going right. And we pretend. We pretend that we are in control of our lives. We pretend that cancer and other illness and car accidents will happen to someone else and not to us. So we don't take much account of that possibility for us. We like to think that justice will be done, and we're surprised when it isn't. We think the truth will out, and that those who are virtuous will be rewarded, and those who are wicked will get what they deserve. But that doesn't happen under the sun. There's no guarantee that that will happen under the sun. And we believe that by saving and careful planning, we can provide financially for ourselves and our families. We discount the possibility of a GFC. We ignore the effects of locusts and of fees for no service and of the third world, where millions and millions and millions of people live on less than $1.90 a day. We imagine we can make a difference in this world and accomplish things of lasting significance in this world. We imagine we can beat out our competitors in love, in business, in fashion, in what we have, or on the sports field. After all, these are some of the reasons we get up and work each day, to beat our competitors in those things. And these are the reasons we can have a midlife crisis when we look back at a certain age and see that we haven't accomplished all that we dreamed that we would and are unlikely to do so before we die. So what the preacher is doing here in his experiment is setting out to demolish our pretending and to burst our bubbles. It tells us some hard truths about living life under the sun after the fall. And he's doing this so that we don't live lives of pretense. The main hard truth that the preacher wants us to take on board is that we are going to die. And while we can enjoy life here, we should not look for lasting significance in what we do and experience here on earth. The second hard truth is that life is hard and difficult and complex. It's not fair and it's full of struggle. That's why this book is a very modern book. Because if you are a secular thinking person, and we're all infected by secularism, that is to say the sense that there's no God, it's just the here and the now, then he's doing an experiment in the here and the now. He's saying, what does it look like? Where do I find meaning in the here and the now if there is no God? Well, he believes in God, but if there's no life after death, what is meaningful? What is enduring? What can I live for? Why am I doing what I am doing? What's the point of it all? Having said he's out there to prick our bubbles, we'll get into that in a bit more detail. I would also say to you that Ecclesiastes is not a book of despair. It is a book of how to live with your eyes wide open to the difficulties of life, but also a book about how to live wisely with your eyes wide open. So the preacher says, don't try to make too much out of this life, because things under the sun cannot provide enduring meaning. But we should try to live life with wisdom, knowing life is not certain or fair, and much of it's out of our control. We should enjoy the gifts God gives in life. And chapter 4 is going to add that wisdom, living wisely in this world we can't control, involves sharing life's gifts with others. Life is giving and sharing, not accumulating and hoarding for ourselves. So, remembering the preacher is coming at us with a very sharp needle to burst our bubbles, our balloons of illusion, so we can hear his advice. Let's have a look at chapter 4. If we could bring that up on the screen, please. In verse 1, the preacher sees the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. Power is on the side of their oppressors. They have no comforter. We don't know what the preacher was looking at when he was doing his experiment of observing and trying the world out. Maybe he saw the beggars being ignored and starving. Maybe he saw the poor and the slaves getting beaten and sold in the markets. Our world is still loaded with injustice and oppression. Just have to read the news. Super trustees have levied fees for no service, including from dead people, for an estimated $850 million. That's a relatively benign first world problem, which has been detected and will be fixed eventually. Franchisors have squeezed the economic life out of franchisees, so they work long hours for very little and their businesses go bust. Some businesses have systematically and illegally underpaid their staff. 47,000 Australian children are in out-of-home care in 2016 and vulnerable to sexual and other abuse. A mother killed her children by driving them into a car in the lake. The International Labour Organization says over 21 million people are in forced labour worldwide. Forced labour, 21 million worldwide, that would be an underestimate. Peter McPherson will be able to tell us about oppression in Haiti. And the Brookings Institute says that India had 70.6 million people living in extreme poverty in 2017, while Nigeria had 87 million. That means those people live on less than $1.90 a day. The tears of the oppressed will fill the oceans, and if we look, we can see them. The preacher had a really good look at oppression in his world, and he said that those who were oppressed were better off dead. In fact, they were better off never having been born. If you go to the next slide, please. Better than both is the one who has never been born, who has not seen the evil under the sun. Now, they're the saddest words in this book. But if we look and we don't distract ourselves, we will also see oppression. Now, I'm not counselling despair. We can and we should fight oppression, but we should also be realistic that under the sun and after the fall, we won't eliminate it because it's part of the human condition arising from our rebellion against God. And then if we go to the next verse, please. Verse 4, the preacher looks at human competition and achievement. And I saw that all toil and achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Well, maybe not all toil and all achievement, but an awful lot. Jesus said we are to love our neighbours. But as David Gibson says in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, what we often feel is what will it take to get what our neighbour has? That job, that house, that beautiful partner. Did you know that the Browns have got new carpets? That they've installed ducted heating? They've bought a new four-wheel drive? And they've got a barbecue with a smoker? And a house in Apollo Bay? Why don't we have those things? Or Adrian's church is growing so fast they put on a new service. How does he do it? How much of our drive to work and to achieve is to stay up with or to beat the people we like to compare ourselves with? The preacher's not criticising work or hard work, but the motive for the work. All this striving and toiling, working and working, is it all about me? What about others? What do they need? And then he contrasts it with the idle person in verse 5. Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. This person is not in the rat race. But this person is also inherently selfish. They fold their hands, they don't work to support themselves, but they don't work to support others either. They may have leisure, but they have nothing to support themselves or give away to others. And they're called a fool. And then the preacher turns his attention to the self-made hard worker. the self-made hard worker in verses 7 to 8. A man all alone, no son, no brother, no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked himself, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless. Vanity, Hebel, a miserable business. What a sad picture. This man is also completely self-absorbed. Could be a woman. He has not done a stock take on his life for a long time. He's ploughed himself into his work and built up his wealth. He's become addicted to work and money, and he's not content with what he has, so he flogs himself even harder to get more. It's not a great competition to be in, to die with the most toys. It won't do the people who play it any good. In fact, playing the competition that he or she who dies with the most toys wins may cost us peace of mind, significant relationships and health. So eventually this man asks himself, why am I doing this? I asked myself this question at midnight on Wednesday when I was trying to get an advice out for a client that was running late. I asked myself this question at midnight on Thursday when I was doing something else. I asked myself this question at midnight last night when I was finishing off the sermon. And I thought, some of this passage is talking to me. But this is the preacher's question to all of us. Why are you doing what you are doing? What is your motivation? I would encourage you to take that home and think about that. The preacher's saying to us, stop chasing the wind. Stop thinking or assuming the future will be better and easier. Don't pour all of your energy into plans for tomorrow because you can't control tomorrow. Stop thinking that if only things were different, you'd be a better person. You don't know the future. You don't know what lies around the corner. Enjoy God's gifts in your life today and share them with others. Because there are some gifts of wisdom in this chapter. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Now that's a beautiful expression, I like that. One handful with tranquility. The preacher says the wise person is content with enough and enjoys what he or she has in peace rather than living in discontent and striving. And you find the same idea in the New Testament. 1 Timothy 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. Great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. And Hebrews 13, 5, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Now, when I was a younger man as a lawyer, I went into a job as a teacher at a university because I thought that's what God wanted me to do. And while my job paid a reasonable wage, it paid a lot less than I could have earned if I'd gone in and been a lawyer in private practice. I lived in a small unit. I drove a second-hand Corolla. I had enough, but I didn't have a lot. Some evenings, I was driving home from lecturing in the city, and I would look at a similar-aged guy in a flash sports car next to me at the lights, and I wish I'd made different choices. Now, I've said it. I may have gone down in your estimation, but it's true. Okay. Later on, I worked out that the guy in the sports car probably had a very big car loan or worked 55 to 60 hours a week or had generous parents. Later on, I took a job where I worked 55 plus hours a week under pressure, and I can tell you there is a big difference between one handful with tranquility and two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. We pay in tranquility. We pay in peace of mind, peace of heart, for the gain we try to hold in our hands. Be content with enough. So in verses 9 to 12, there's another gift of wisdom. Two are better than one. Life under the sun is better shared with others. Now, this passage is not primarily a reference to marriage, although many preachers use it that way. It is about mutual help, strength, comfort, and protection that an alliance with other people can bring. It includes marriage, but it also includes friendships, workmates, team members, family members, business partners, and good neighbours. The reference to the three-stranded cord, which comes a little bit later, it shows it's not just about alliances of two people. So the preacher's saying it's a better thing under the sun for two or more people who trust each other to support each other and work together. So the wisdom contained in chapter 4 is about not being self-absorbed, not striving for too much, but sharing the gifts of life which God gives. Looking out for people we know, and let's look out for people we know who don't have those types of human alliances. The lonely. See if we can be their ally, a neighbour, a friend, a support. So, the preacher has said to us, wake up. Stop pretending. You're going to die. If you have a loved one or a children, they're going to die. Life on earth bounded by death is fleeting and difficult, sometimes awful. It's not possible to find long-term enduring meaning just in this life on the earth. But you can live wisely and you can enjoy the gifts of God. Just don't try to build a castle of enduring meaning out of this life. Nevertheless, God has placed eternity in the hearts of men and women. We search for meaning and significance. If we don't find it ultimately in our relationship with God, we're going to manufacture meaning. The soccer game will be crucial. The love interest will be crucial. The empire we are building, the business or whatever it is, will become crucial. Our money, our possessions, our attempts to control life, our achievements, our family, our bodies, our health, our beauty, or a cause bigger than ourselves will become the thing that we invest in, that we find ultimate meaning in. But as the preacher says, there is no ultimate meaning in any of those things. They can hold lesser and temporary meaning or significance, but they do not have lasting significance unless they are put in the context of a relationship with God and a life beyond death. Now, as Christians, we know there is an ultimate meaning. It is that we were made for a relationship with God who loves us and wants us to live in his family forever. I keep going back to Ephesians 1 and Ephesians 2 because that tells me that God, before the beginning of time, loved us and chose us in Christ to be holy and blameless in his sight and predestined us to be adopted into his family, to live with him forever. That's the ultimate meaning. Like the preacher, we were never going to find or enter into that sort of an ultimate meaning if we limit our vision to life under the sun and try to work it out ourselves by observation and experiment. Because we are alienated from God by our self-centeredness and our sin. And one symptom of that is wrestling with a sense of purposelessness. We groan together with the creation, trying to invest what's temporary with ultimate significance. We couldn't do it on our own. We couldn't find the answer to the preacher's question. So God came himself to show us the ultimate meaning. He came in the form of a man, Jesus Christ, to show us how to live and to end our alienation from God by dying for us. So on the cross, Jesus, who was God, was cut off from the Father as we deserve to be cut off, and he paid the debt we owed for our rebellion. He got life without God on the cross so we could have life with God. The ultimate meaning behind the universe is a person who came to find us when we were lost. He died for us so that we could be adopted into his family for eternity. Trusting our rescuer by faith will give us an eternal life, an eternal family, and a purpose in relationship with God that the death of our present bodies cannot take away from us. The meaning is a person. We are eternal beings of so much worth to God that he came and died for us to adopt us into his family for all time. And the road to the meaning is to trust in that person, Jesus.